such an honor and a pleasure to be here today and to get to talk about the Great Depression, a topic near and dear to my heart. Now, as Professor Griswold just mentioned, I took a detour out of academia and into economic policymaking when President Obama asked me to chair his Council of Economic Advisors back in 2008. And after I'd been in Washington for a while, a reporter asked me, "So why did you get the job?" And since I didn't know and had always wondered, I decided I'd ask Rahm Emanuel, the president's somewhat intimidating chief of staff. And I was a little worried about what the answer would be. Oh, we needed a woman, or nobody else would work with Larry Summers. But instead, Rahm gave an answer that I just loved. He said, "You were an expert on the Great Depression, and we thought we might need one." Now, the president and his hiring team clearly believed that there were lessons from the Great Depression that might be relevant to economic policymaking during those scary months of late 2008 and early 2009, when the United States faced the first widespread financial crisis we had had since the Great Depression. So in my talk this morning, I want to discuss what some of those lessons might be. And I'll be frank, not all of these are lessons that I knew back in 2008. The learning has absolutely gone in both directions. The Great Depression informed many of my policy recommendations, but living through another terrible crisis has changed some of my views on what was most relevant or important about the experience of the 1930s. Also, the recent crisis has just generated a lot of interest and some wonderful new research on the Great Depression. So we know things today that we didn't know back in 2008. Now, to keep things manageable this morning, I want to focus mainly on the recovery period of the Great Depression. That is starting around 1933. Now, why the American and the world economies plummeted between 1929 and 1933 could fill many hours of its own lecture. The essential fact is that consumers and businesses stopped spending. We had a huge fall in aggregate demand, and that mattered because when people stopped buying, firms stopped producing and hiring. People lose their jobs, and the economy falls even further. Now, policy mistakes clearly played a role in why spending collapsed. In particular, the fact that the Federal Reserve did little to stem the repeated waves of banking panics is a major reason why the downturn was so horrific and lasted so long. But in the spring of 1933, the American economy finally turned the corner. Shortly after Franklin Roosevelt's inauguration, consumers and businesses did start spending again. And as a result, firms started to produce again, and unemployment began its long, hard journey down from more than 25% of the labor force. Well, I want to discuss the role that policy played in that turnaround and recovery. What seems to have worked and why? Now, of course, policy is not the whole story. Once the economy turned around, new innovations, business leadership, and plain old hard work on the part of employees were critical to driving the recovery. But I want to focus on the lessons we can learn from the Depression about the role that government can play in helping to start and sustain a recovery. Now, the policy lessons, I think, fall into three broad areas: fiscal policy, the use of government spending and tax changes; monetary policy, decisions about the money supply and interest rates; and credit policy, measures to deal with consumer debt and the rising tide of foreclosures and debt defaults. And in each case, what I'm going to do is I'll describe what policies were used back in the 1930s and give you a sense of how well they worked. I'll especially try to give you a feel for the evidence that scholars have amassed about the impact of these policies on the recovery and the lessons we've learned from the experience of the 1930s. Then I'll look a bit at the degree to which those lessons from the Great Depression were or were not incorporated into the policy response to the most recent crisis. Did we, in fact, learn from the past? And the answer, you'll see, is only partly. And finally, I'll suggest some ways that policy could evolve going forward. What does the experience from the Great Depression suggest could still be done to make the American economy stronger and healthier going forward? Okay, so let me start with fiscal policy. What do we learn about the effectiveness of changes in government spending and taxes as a recovery tool from the experience of the 1930s? And I'd sum it up this way: fiscal policy works when it is tried. All right? So in theory, when output is low because demand is low, changes in the government budget can be helpful. So a tax cut can put money into people's pockets and so encourage consumption. And government spending on things like roads and bridges can create demand for steel and concrete and can put construction workers back on the job. And what I think we learn from the Depression is that theory is confirmed by empirical evidence. When fiscal policy was used in the 1930s, it did help to spur recovery. The main problem was it just wasn't used very much. All right, so what's the record from the Great Depression? Well, most of the academic research, my own included, has emphasized that relative to the size of the problem, Roosevelt's fiscal policy actions were actually pretty small. So in no year, for example, was the increase in the federal budget deficit more than a few percent of GDP. And against an unemployment rate of 25%, that's fairly weak medicine. And fiscal policy was also somewhat erratic. It varied between fairly expansionary one year, then contractionary the next. And it's the fact that there was never a sustained large fiscal expansion that led one scholar to very famously conclude that fiscal policy was, quote, an unsuccessful recovery device in the 30s, not because it did not work, but because it was not tried. Now, while that's largely true, I think it overstates the case. There were times when fiscal policy was tried somewhat in the 1930s, and in those cases, it does appear to have been helpful. So one time was in the winter of 1934. So faced with a destitute population and a harsh winter, the government established the Civil Works Administration to just directly hire the unemployed. The CWA workers did everything from laying sewer pipes to improving roads to building playgrounds. But what I find most amazing as someone who has been to Washington is the fact that the program managed to hire more than 4 million people in a matter of just a few months. That is a speed and scale of results that, frankly, is hard to fathom in today's world. Another time when fiscal policy was tried was in 1936 with the veterans bonus. So back in the 1920s, veterans of World War I had been promised a bonus, and very much reminiscent of what our policymakers do today, the bonus was to be paid in 1945. So as the Depression dragged on and veterans were facing high unemployment, they pushed hard to get that bonus payment early. And there were huge marches in Washington by what came to be called the Bonus Army, of these veterans lobbying to get the money early. And finally, in 1936, Congress agreed to pay the bonus early. Now, interestingly, President Roosevelt actually vetoed the bill, so it only became law when Congress passed it over his veto. Now, the bonus was very large, so the total amount of money that we're talking about is about 2% of GDP, but for the 3.2 million veterans that actually got it, it was enormous. Right? It was $547 back in 1936, which in today's prices would be about $10,000. Right? Well, we have a wonderful new study, actually done by a graduate student at Berkeley, that looks at a wide range of evidence and finds that it all points to the same conclusion, and that is that the bonus actually raised consumer spending and stimulated output and employment. And one of my favorite pieces of evidence that this student has dug up was a long-forgotten survey done by the American Legion, which before the bonus came into effect, had done a survey of their members to say, what would you do with it? And many of them said that they absolutely would spend it. Many said they were planning to buy a new car, which coincidentally cost about $500 back in 1936. And actually, if you look at car registrations across states in 1936, it confirms that states that had a higher fraction of veterans had lots more car sales per capita than other states. All told, the study suggests that this one expansionary fiscal action reduced the unemployment rate by about 1.5 percentage points in 1936. Now, given that the unemployment rate, even with the bonus, was still 17%, that wasn't nearly enough. But it was unquestionably a help. Hence my lesson, fiscal policy works when it is tried. Now, just to drive home the impact of fiscal policy in the 30s, we have a good example from this period of contractionary fiscal policy working in the opposite direction. Now, in 1937, fiscal policy swung strongly from expansion to contraction. So part of this was just that the veterans bonus was a one-time payment, so it was there in 1936, and it disappears in 1937, so you see government spending go down. But we also increased taxes as well. 1937 was the first year we collected Social Security taxes. And all told, the budget deficit adjusted for the state of the economy fell pretty dramatically by about 4% of a year's GDP. And output plummeted. We had a second recession in 1938. Indeed, I think one reason why we tend to think of the recovery from the Great Depression as having been very slow was that there were, in fact, two severe downturns. The economy had recovered a lot in the mid-1930s, only to fall again in 1938. Now, fiscal contraction is not the only cause of this second recession, but studies suggest it was an important contributor. So that's another piece of evidence from the 1930s that absolutely fiscal policy matters. Finally, since today's teach-in covers both the Great Depression and World War II, I should mention that World War II was also a pretty big fiscal stimulus. Now, both taxes and government spending went up, but spending went up much more. So the budget deficit clearly got bigger. Now, one of the claims that I often fight against as an economist is this idea that, well, World War II is what ended the Great Depression. Because I think it's important to realize we'd made a lot of progress in getting back to normal long before 1941. But the war absolutely had an impact. And the fact that output and employment surged during the war, despite rationing and lots of other methods used to limit private consumption, is, I think, some of the strongest evidence we have that expansionary fiscal policy raises growth when it's used. All right, well, now this lesson from the Depression, that fiscal policy works when it is tried, is one that was followed somewhat in the response to the Great Recession. And in fact, the fiscal policy response to the troubles in 2007 and 2008 actually started remarkably early. Back in February of 2008, President Bush and Congress passed a tax rebate of up to $1,200 per family. And though there's some debate among economists about what it accomplished, my own reading of the evidence is that it was helpful. And in fact, a very careful study using individual level spending data suggests that people really did go out and spend those rebate checks. Indeed, just like the veterans back in 1936, a surprisingly large number went out and bought cars. And this finding absolutely resonates with me because the day my father got his rebate check, he went right out and bought himself a new Honda CR-V. Now, the even larger fiscal policy response to the 2008 recession came with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The Recovery Act, which was passed just a month after President Obama was inaugurated, was larger relative to the state of the economy than anything Roosevelt had done back in the Great Depression. It was a mixture of tax cuts, government spending, and aid to people who'd been directly harmed by the recession. Now, we could have a long discussion on what the Recovery Act accomplished. It remains a highly controversial action. And since I helped design it, I'm clearly biased in favor of thinking that it was very helpful. In fact, I am such a fan that a few Christmases ago, My daughter made me a needlepoint Christmas ornament of that little green, or that big green sign, the Recovery Act sign that you see at every construction site supported by the Act. I am sure we are the only Christmas tree that has a Recovery Act ornament on it. But I will tell you that my sense of the emerging unbiased academic research is that the Act did contribute to recovery, though some parts of the Act were decidedly more successful than others. Ironically, the mistake that I feel we made was exactly the one that economic historians criticized Franklin Roosevelt for. As it turned out, the fiscal expansion included in the Recovery Act was too small relative to the problems we were facing. Even if it did shave 1.5 to 2 percentage points off the unemployment rate relative to what otherwise would have happened, as a number of studies suggest, the unemployment rate still went up to 10%. So clearly, we had not learned the lesson from the Great Depression nearly well enough. Another place where I see countries throughout the world perhaps failing to learn from the 1930s is in understanding the costs of fiscal consolidation. I mentioned that the switch to deficit reduction back in 1937 was one of the factors leading up to the 1938 recession. Well, after the meltdown in Greece in 2010, countries throughout the world started to worry about their budget deficits. And that led to fiscal austerity in a number of countries, tax increases, reductions in government spending. And interestingly, many governments convinced themselves that such austerity would not be painful, that perhaps it would even be good for economic growth. And yet the results have been remarkably similar to what happened in the United States in 1938. So countries like the United Kingdom and many members of the euro area have seen growth stop and unemployment rise as they have cut their budget deficits. And the outcomes have been worse in countries that have moved more sharply to austerity. So now, fiscal austerity is certainly not the only cause of the problems in these troubled countries, but it is unquestionably a factor. Okay, so I've talked about fiscal policy in the Depression and how well we have learned from that experience. Are there implications going forward? I think there are. You know, the lesson that fiscal policy works when it is tried suggests that countries should try to keep themselves in a position to use this powerful tool. If you look at the countries that used fiscal policy most aggressively to fight the 2008 recession, it was the countries that began with low levels of government debt. Nations like China and Australia and South Korea were able to take aggressive fiscal expansion because they'd run very responsible fiscal policy in the 2000s. This suggests that countries should work hard to run balanced or even surplus budgets in normal times so that they can run budget deficits when their economies are hit by a severe recession. And I think the lesson from 1938 that cutting deficits is painful suggests that countries may want to move more cautiously as they try to get their looming budget deficits under control. Now, I believe incredibly strongly that countries like the United States need to deal with their long-run budget problems. We are on an unsustainable path, and we have to fix it. But we need to be smart about how we do it. And understanding that tax increases and spending cuts will tend to reduce growth and increase unemployment means we may want to phase in that deficit reduction gradually as other factors start to strengthen the economy. Okay, well, that's a lot about fiscal policy. How about monetary policy? Did we learn something from the 1930s about how to use this tool? And again, I think the answer is yes. And I'd sum up the lesson for monetary policy this way. It takes a regime shift. So let me explain what I mean. Monetary policy usually refers to the actions that central banks take regarding interest rates, the money supply, things like that. And the usual thing that a central bank would do in times of depression is to lower interest rates. That makes it easier for businesses and families to borrow and spend, and that helps to put people back to work. The problem in 1933, just like today, is that we started with interest rates already down to zero. The economist buzz phrase is that we were at the zero lower bound. That just means that nominal interest rates can't go lower than zero. So this usual tool that the central bank would use of reducing nominal rates wasn't available in 1933. Well, at the zero lower bound, is there anything that monetary policy can do? And it turns out that President Roosevelt stumbled on a solution, which is monetary policy can work on people's expectations. And it does this in a couple of ways. So first of all, during the declining phase of the Great Depression, so that 1929 to 1933, there was lots of deflation. And that just means that prices fell dramatically. For example, the price of a bushel of wheat fell from $1.02 in 1929 to just 36 cents in 1932. And because prices had fallen so much, people expected them, naturally, to keep falling. Now, such expectations of deflation can affect consumer behavior. If people keep expecting goods to get cheaper and cheaper, they may put off spending. And my husband's grandmother tells a great story of buying furniture in the Great Depression. When she saw something that she liked in a store, she'd just wait a few months because inevitably the price just kept coming down and down. And then she'd get it for a nice low price. Now, that made complete sense for her family budget, but the problem was that everybody had the same incentive to postpone their spending. And what happens in an economy is with falling spending, firms produce less, more workers lose their jobs, and so spending falls further, taking us down that downward spiral. Also, when people expect deflation, the cost of borrowing, even at a zero interest rate, is actually pretty high. Right? You understand that you're going to have to pay back these loans with dollars that are worth a lot more in terms of buying power because you expect prices to go down. So that's another reason why people held back spending and investing in the early 1930s. Well, the idea is that if monetary policy can stop these expectations of deflation and perhaps even turn them slightly into expectations of a little inflation, that could be very helpful. Instead of waiting, consumers might want to spend right away before prices go up. And if people expect inflation, a zero stated interest rate starts to look pretty good because they think the dollars they'll be paying back are going to be worth less. So both businesses and consumers might be more interested in taking out loans to buy a new machine or a new car. Now, it's not only price expectations that matter. In the early 1930s, of course, people were pretty gloomy about the state of the rest of the economy, right? The fear about what future output and employment didn't look very good. And after 3 years of high unemployment and low sales, firms were pretty naturally nervous about buying new machines or building a new factory, and consumers were hesitant to buy anything. Well, again, if monetary policy can somehow work on people's expectations, make them more optimistic about future growth, that can be a powerful incentive to start buying again. If I think I'm likely to have a job next year, I'm much more likely to buy a car because I'll know I'll be able to make the payments. Or as a factory owner, if I think my sales are about to take off, I'm much more likely to hire some new workers and buy some new machines. So that's the theory. That's the theory of how monetary policy could still matter even when nominal rates are at zero. But how do you actually change people's expectations? Well, one answer is what economists call a regime shift, right? And that just means you take a dramatic action that's very different from anything that was done before. Policymakers shake up policy so much that people can't help but notice, and it may cause them to expect economic outcomes to be different. Right? And that's exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did in early 1933. A wonderful old paper by Peter Tamman and Barry Wigmore that I've come to appreciate more and more as time's gone by said that Roosevelt's monetary actions were particularly important, right? And that the defining event of his regime shift was going off the gold standard. All right, well, let me give you a little background. So the United States had been on some form of a gold standard since the late 1800s. And though it worked pretty well for most of that period, in the Depression, the gold standard was a burden. Having your currency tied to gold, and then implicitly to every other currency that was also tied to gold, at a fixed price, limits what your country can do about policy. For example, in 1931, the American economy was in the middle of a terrible banking panic, and yet the Federal Reserve nevertheless decided to jack up interest rates by 2 percentage points because it was worried about gold outflows and was trying to defend the gold standard. So going off the gold standard was a very dramatic signal that Roosevelt was going to concentrate on healing the American economy. He wanted to be able to take aggressive action without any constraints from the foreign currency markets. Now, Roosevelt followed this dramatic action with old-fashioned monetary expansion. Now, during the downturn part of the Depression, the money supply had fallen sharply. As people lost confidence in banks, cash had been pulled out of financial institutions and stuffed into mattresses. And because the Fed didn't counteract this change, the money in circulation just dropped precipitously. And this is one of the conclusions of Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz's classic book, A Monetary History of the United States. Now, the Fed was not any more interested in increasing the money supply in 1933 than it had been back in 1931. But Roosevelt's Treasury Department found a way to do it on its own. And it involved the fact that devaluation had increased the value of our gold reserves, and the Treasury was allowed to issue things that looked just like dollar bills, but were called gold certificates, on the basis of those reserves. And then gold kept flowing into the United States in the mid and late 1930s because of political tensions in Europe. And as a result, the Treasury was able to keep increasing the money supply for a number of years. It's probably the only time in our history that we've had a monetary expansion done by the executive branch, not by the Federal Reserve. Well, finally, Roosevelt also used his powerful tool of communications to drive home the idea of his regime shift. For example, if you go back and read or listen to his second fireside chat back in May of 1933, there he is on the radio talking about the gold standard. And he carefully explained to his listeners, and I'll quote, "The administration has the definite objective of raising commodity prices to such an extent that those who have borrowed money will, on average, be able to repay that money in the same kind of dollar which they borrowed." So clearly, through a variety of actions, policymakers were trying to change people's expectations. So what's the evidence about Roosevelt's monetary regime shift and whether it actually made a difference? Well, there's lots. For example, one of the first things that happened was the stock market took off. Now, stock prices are very sensitive to expectations about the future state of the economy. And stock prices, you probably remember, were falling steadily through the early years of the 1930s. They rose 87% in the 3 months after Roosevelt abandoned the gold standard and then just kept going up. Price expectations also changed radically. Now, you might be wondering, people don't usually write down what they're expecting prices to be next week or next year. But it turns out they do often sign contracts to sell agricultural goods in the future. And one economist had the clever idea to get those futures contracts and to deduce what people must have been expecting to happen to prices in the mid-1930s. And what he found is that expectations just switched dramatically in the spring of 1933 from a large expected deflation to a small amount of expected inflation. And that was a huge change. Now, these expectations of price increases, along with the direct effects of devaluation on the price of some agricultural goods, led to a big rise in the expected incomes of farmers. You know, the price of wheat that I told you had dropped so much went from 36 cents in 1932 back up to 87 cents in 1933. And Temin and Wigmore showed that one of the first things to take off in the recovery from the Great Depression was truck sales. Right? Farmers finally felt confident enough about their future income, they decided to go out and buy trucks and tractors and invest in their farms. More generally, the spending and output that took off in the spring of 1933 were things that were usually bought on credit. So machines and vehicles for businesses, consumer durables like cars and furniture. And all of this is consistent with the fact that Roosevelt's actions lowered the real cost of borrowing by ending expectations of deflation. So what we learn, I think, from the Depression is that even when interest rates are at zero, monetary policy isn't helpless. But for it to work, it has to change people's expectations about future prices and incomes. And to do that in a big way, it takes a regime shift. Now, interestingly, in 1936, Roosevelt and other policymakers got cold feet. Right? They had talked a lot about the benefits of inflation and rapid growth in the mid-1930s, but then when it actually started to happen, they got very nervous. And everybody started talking about the dangers of inflation, and we actually had a bit of a regime shift in the opposite direction. The Federal Reserve raised reserve requirements on banks to try to slow things down. The Treasury Department stopped monetizing the gold that kept flowing into the U.S. So just as we had a fiscal contraction in 1937, we also had a monetary contraction. And scholars think that's yet another reason why the economy went back down in 1938. So this lesson from monetary policy from the Great Depression, that at the zero lower bound, it takes a regime shift, well, has that been followed in the recent episode? And here I'd have to say not really. But there are signs that at least some countries are beginning to get the message. So here in the United States, the Federal Reserve responded very aggressively to the evolving financial crisis in the summer and fall of 2008. And by December of that year, the main interest rate that the Federal Reserve controls, something called the federal funds rate, was effectively down to zero. And since then, they've taken a number of unusual measures. So if you follow the newspapers, you know that we are now in round three of quantitative easing, which just means that the Fed buys a lot of certain assets like long-term government bonds or mortgage-backed securities to try to lower some interest rate that's not yet down to zero. And those policies, I think, have been somewhat helpful. But of course, unemployment remains very high, and inflation has consistently come in below the Fed's target of 2% over the past several years. Exactly what the Fed hasn't been willing to do is something nearly as dramatic as what Roosevelt did. They've not wanted to change their goals or their operating procedures in a way that might seriously rock the boat of public expectations. So what they've been doing is maybe pushing on the boundaries of their current regime, but not changing the regime. The place where we might see a country trying to follow the Depression lesson is actually Japan. So Japan went through what we experienced in 2008, almost 20 years before we did. Now, if you remember, back in the 1980s, Japan's economy was the envy of the world, right? But then they had a bubble and bust in their housing market that wreaked havoc on their financial system and caused a prolonged downturn. And they hit the zero lower bound on interest rates in the late 1990s and just kind of got stuck in a trap of low growth and steady price declines. Unlike almost every other advanced country in the world, Japan has had deflation for the last 15 years. But like our Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan has not wanted to take any kind of dramatic action. But that all appears to be changing. So in December, a new government was elected, and the new prime minister, Shinzo Abe, is doing something of a Franklin Roosevelt imitation. He's proposed an expansion in government spending to help growth, and he said very explicitly that he would like the value of their currency to be lower. And indeed, the yen has fallen by about 20% in just the past few months. And Prime Minister Abe even got the head of the Bank of Japan to resign early and has just nominated a new governor who has committed to a much more aggressive monetary policy, including a higher target rate of inflation and unlimited quantitative easing. So for economic historians who believe that Roosevelt's regime shift was essential, Japan may be a key modern test. Abe is following the Depression playbook, and we'll all be watching to see if it works. All right, well, are there implications from the lesson, it takes a regime shift, for the United States going forward? Possibly. If the current actions being taken by the Federal Reserve don't do enough and the U.S. recovery remains anemic, we may need to do more. And the Fed may have to think about dramatic or more visible actions. And one strategy that a number of economists have suggested is to adopt a whole new framework for monetary policymaking. For example, the Fed might commit itself to a target for the path of nominal GDP. Now, this is not the place to go into the details of the proposal, but the basic idea is that it's an approach that commits the Fed to low inflation and steady growth in the long run, but also to healing the economy more quickly in the near term. From the perspective of today's discussion, what's most important about it is it would pretty clearly be a regime shift. It would be a very different way of conducting and talking about monetary policy. And so, like Roosevelt's actions, it might have more impact on expectations than the more incremental changes that the Fed has been following so far. Okay, so that's monetary policy. The third and final policy from the recovery from the Great Depression that I want to highlight involves what do we do about high levels of consumer debt? And I'd summarize this lesson as it's important to get debt burdens down. Now, many things affect how much consumers want to spend. So obviously, their income's a main determinant. And as we've discussed, their expectations about future employment and future prices can play an important role. But another thing that matters is how much debt they have. And one of the things that can happen in an economy in good times is that consumers take on a lot of debt and they feel okay about it. But then a recession comes and people feel unsure about their jobs, the value of their houses and their pensions fall, and suddenly those debt burdens look awfully scary. And consumers respond by hunkering down and focusing on paying off debt and so cut their spending. Now, this may be very good for their long-run financial health, but it can be devastating to the economy. And if we find ourselves in that kind of a situation, government policies to try to help consumers get their debt loads down more quickly can be helpful. All right, so what happened during the Depression? Well, both the Great Depression and the recent crisis were preceded by a huge increase in consumer debt. You know, the 1920s are in fact called the Consumer Durables Revolution, because that's when families first started to routinely own things like cars and washing machines and refrigerators. And going along with that was a large expansion of consumer debt. Mortgage debt also increased rapidly in the 1920s. This was often not the nice long-term amortizing mortgages like we have today. Much of the mortgage debt back in the 1920s were short-term, interest-only loans with a big balloon payment of the principal due at the end of a short period. Well, when stock prices plummeted in 1929 and unemployment began to soar, those high debt loads started to cause problems. And actually, a very nice paper by my colleague, Martha Olney, points out a really peculiar feature of 1920s consumer loans. Many of them stipulated that if you missed a payment and your car was repossessed, you lost all of the equity that you had in the car. So even if it was mainly paid off, you got no compensation. And she argues that this feature gave consumers a very strong incentive to cut everything except their car payments. Cut back on groceries, cut back on clothes, don't buy anything else, but for heaven's sakes, make your car payment. And this may help explain why consumer spending fell so dramatically in 1930. So what policies were used during the recovery from the Great Depression to deal with the high debts of consumers? Well, the most important was surely the Homeowners Loan Corporation. Set up in the summer of 1933, the HOLC, or the Incredible Hulk, as one author likes to call it, basically refinanced a lot of home mortgages, more than a million to be precise, almost 10% of all of the homes in the country, mortgaged or not. And because the HOLC would only refinance about 80% of the fair market value of the house, a bank wanting to get rid of a troubled mortgage often had to agree to a principal reduction. Now, importantly, both sides benefited from this, because the homeowner was typically far behind in their payments and likely to default. The bank was usually very happy to write down the principal to get rid of the loan. And, of course, the homeowner got the benefit of a new government mortgage at the lower amount and on very favorable terms. And this program helped to get consumers out from some of their debt burdens and into much more affordable mortgages. Now, we don't actually have a lot of direct evidence that the HOLC and other New Deal programs to reduce debt burdens spurred recovery, but there is some indirect evidence. Most obviously, consumer spending on durables rebounded around the same time that the HOLC was renegotiating a lot of mortgages. Likewise, building starts began to rise around the same time, which could suggest that dealing with foreclosures and negative equity played a role in stabilizing the housing sector in the 1930s. The main reason that I tend to believe that these moves to reduce debt loads in the Depression were important actually comes from the recent experience. This is a case where I feel we've learned something about the Depression from living through the 2008 recession. As in the 1920s, consumer debt burdens rose dramatically in the 2000s. Household debt as a fraction of personal income went from about 80% in 2000 to 115% in 2007. And much of that increase was in mortgage debt, including many of us took out home equity loans. Well, there's great new research about how devastating high consumer debt loads were to consumer spending in this recession. And it's a wonderful study. Researchers got data on average debt for every county in the United States from one of the big credit reporting bureaus. And what they did was to look at things like car sales by county during and after the crisis. And what they found is that counties with high debt loads coming into the recession have seen much slower recovery of car sales than counties that started with lower debt loads. And based on this finding and a range of other studies, economists have come to appreciate, I think, in a way I think we didn't back in 2008, just how much debt matters for consumer spending. And this evidence suggests that the measures taken to get debt down quickly in the Great Depression and the New Deal were likely very helpful. But this lesson, it's important to get debt loads down quickly, is not one that we followed in this current episode. When the bubble burst and incomes fell, many families were in a very bad way. We all know that delinquent mortgages and foreclosures surged. And as I described, consumer spending fell as families concentrated on paying off debt. But despite understanding the problem, we've not really found a way to do widespread mortgage renegotiation. Financial institutions themselves have been very hesitant to do it on their own. And the various government programs aimed at helping homeowners have mainly focused at reducing their payments, not at reducing principal and debt loads. And of course, far fewer people have participated in those programs than initially hoped. And as a result, we've basically been left to wait for consumers to gradually pay off their debts and get back on their feet. And it's been a long, hard progress, and I think one that's contributed to the very slow recovery in the past few years. So how does the experience of the 1930s suggest that credit policy should evolve going forward? Well, here I think there are lots of possibilities. One involves thinking about ways to prevent unhealthy surges in consumer debt so we don't find ourselves with high debt loads in the first place. And there's been much discussion about regulatory changes and improvements in financial education that might be worthwhile. Another possibility involves what to do about the problem of over-indebtedness if it arises. You know, early in my time in Washington, Congress debated reforming the household bankruptcy law. So under current law, bankruptcy judges are able to renegotiate most consumer debt contracts, but not mortgages. The only option for home mortgages in bankruptcy is foreclosure. Well, one possible change going forward would be to let bankruptcy judges reduce principal and change other terms of a mortgage. That's something we let judges do in the case of farm bankruptcies, and it's worked quite well. I suspect that in many cases it would be better for both the borrower and the lender because so much value is lost when a home is sold through foreclosure. And if there is another period of high debt and problems in the housing market, it would be much better for the economy to have a way to reduce debt loads for very troubled families. So there's a concrete way that we could take a lesson from the Great Depression to make the economy more resilient going forward. All right, well, where does all of this leave us? You know, I will be the first to admit that the Great Depression is not a perfect model for today. The world has changed in important ways since the 1930s, and so has our economy. But I hope I've convinced you that this searing experience nevertheless does have lessons for today. The Depression teaches us that tax cuts and increases in government spending can help to heal a depressed economy, but only if they're used on a sufficiently large scale. It shows that when interest rates are at zero, monetary policy can still be effective, but it will likely take a regime shift. Policy needs to be dramatic enough that it changes people's expectations about future prices and output. And finally, when debt burdens are high, measures to get them down quickly may be very beneficial, not just to the people directly affected, but to the whole economy. But perhaps the most important lesson about policy from the Great Depression is something deeper than these specific ones that I've highlighted. More than anything, what I admire about policymakers in the 1930s was their sense of urgency and their willingness to experiment. Faced with a crisis of unprecedented pain and severity, they took bold action. Now, not everything they did worked as planned, and believe me, some policies were clear failures. But as I've discussed this morning, many actions were successful in helping to jumpstart recovery and repair the devastated American economy. So as we face our own challenges, continued high unemployment, a terrible long-run budget deficit, and Europe perennially on the edge of a meltdown, I think we need some of that same sense of urgency and willingness to experiment. We need to learn from the past, of course, but we also need to forge new solutions for the future. That, I think, is the true lesson of the Great Depression. Thank you.